Podcast One.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. Well, there's a slim chance you might have heard of Sir Martin Sorrell and his new baby, S4 Capital. As we hear regularly from him on various stages around the world, S4 is everything he dreamed of doing as the brainchild behind the global marketing services giant WPP, but didn't, couldn't or wouldn't, take your pick. But with us today is Mr. Sorrell's hand-picked CEO for the Asia-Pacific region, Michelle Derique. Michelle was previously the big boss at WPP's global digital and data trading unit, Zaxis. I'm not sure whether it's true, but legend has it that Sir Martin chose Michelle because, wait for it, he always delivered on the numbers. Zaxis could be a five-hour conversation alone, but we don't have that. To S4, however, it has been very active in the Australian market in the past year, making acquisitions across marketing technology and customer experience firms, building out S4's $350 million global acquisition of Media Monks in Australia and its digital media unit Mighty Hive. So hopefully today we're going to find out what the hell S4 is and what it's up to in Australia and the region and why it is spooking so many of the big holding companies. So welcome, Michelle. Before we get into the bigger picture across the region, we've mentioned that S4 has been active in Australia. Why such the interest in this market? We're comparatively small. For instance, Mighty Hive's Asia-Pacific headquarters is based in Sydney. What's going on with S4's seemingly intense interest down under?
Yeah, so why the interest in Australia? I think it's, you're right, Australia is a relatively smaller advertising market globally. But I do think it's a very important one. And, you know, as part of my remit in Asia Pacific, I think it's one of the key three, four markets across the region that we have identified as extremely important. The reason why we entered Australia as sort of the first market in Asia Pacific had partly to do with the fact that Mighty Hive, when we merged with them, and as we don't call them acquisitions, when we merged with Mighty Hive, actually, the first international office was in Sydney, while they're originally a San Francisco-based organization. So they opened up probably about four or five years ago in Sydney, gave us a good base there. And then we started to look at other opportunities of expansion globally. And, you know, we ended up in Australia twice after that as well. And so far, that has been a very interesting foundation for us across the region.
For those that may not know what Mighty Hive does, Michelle, it's a digital media business, programmatic and so forth, yeah?
Yeah, so it's a programmatic consultancy business. I would describe it ourselves. And, you know, if you take sort of the bigger picture of S4 is a business that, as we call it, the services business built on top of the key technology platforms globally. So the Googles, the Amazons, the Adobes, the Alibaba's, Tencent, etc. And our entrance into Australia was through Mighty Hive, and Mighty Hive was one of the first Adobe sort of partners in the Google Marketing Platform program. So that is the foundation of the business indeed. So it's a programmatic consultancy business, mainly focusing around analytics and data.
Media Monks is another business that you've got operating in Australia, but it's only about 12 months in this market. Is that right?
No, so I think Media Monks is an interesting one. I have to think back. It's almost a year. Yeah, it's about a year ago that we merged with a company in Australia, mainly a Melbourne-based company called BizTech, which is a Adobe development company, mainly focusing on Adobe AEM and Adobe Campaign and Adobe Analytics. And we've rebranded BizTech into Media Monks. And then since a few months, we're active with what we sort of would describe the Media Monks content a production business at the back of obviously our presence in market through the Adobe merger that we did, as well as the Mighty Hive business. So at this stage, we've got three different businesses in market that, you know, working very closely together and will be as united as much as possible. One is the Mighty Hive business, which is our programmatic consultancy business. One is what we would describe as like the old BizTech, which we now call Media Monks Global Solutions. It's around the Adobe practice. And then the third one is, you would almost describe it as the more original Media Monks, and that is a creative production and content business.
So you're building out the Media Monks in terms of creative production. That's a talent-based development, then. You're hiring people to build that out rather than buy something that's here in Australia at the moment.
I mean, look, both options are there. Like the we will have in all key markets, how we look at it, we have both an organic and an inorganic strategy, and they are not mutually exclusive. So we have conversations also in Australia with businesses that we might see as good fits to strengthen the creative content production side as well. And at the same time, we're building organically a team on the ground. And I think the interesting part is that if you, for example, take the business that we have right now, and that's about 140, 150 people in Australia itself across Sydney and Melbourne, we have a lot of good relationships with clients in Australia on the platform builds around sort of Adobe. Now, of course, there is UI, UX, and campaign materials necessary for that. So it's a good sort of jump start into the content creative production business. And at the same time, we have Mighty Hive that obviously has a lot of client relationships on the analytics side and on the data side and on the programmatic media buying side. And there's a lot of creative content production needs as well. So eventually sort of stitches it all together. And then we build businesses, the business around it through, what I said, both organic by doing a lot of recruitment at the moment in market and across the region, as well as continue to look at other potential merger and acquisition opportunities.
What does S4 look like and the group, those divisions you talk about, what does it look like in Australia at least in 12 months' time? For those that perhaps hear a lot about Sir Martin Sorrell and hear a lot about S4, not as visible here yet, how would you define the business and where's the opportunity? We hear obviously a lot about it being a new world holding company, but put some flesh on the bones for us there, Michelle.
It's interesting. If I look at as an outsider into sort of the Australian market, and you know, I've been lucky enough to fly in and out, well, not at the moment, but previously pretty frequent to Australia itself, and looking at that market and having operated in that market, I think there's really room and space for a disruptor at the moment. I think if you look at the holding companies, they've been struggling. They're struggling now, but I think they've been struggling for the last, let's say, year and a half or 2 years. I think the consultancy businesses are, I think, slightly too far from reality and the direct client needs right now and being able to operate and act quickly. And I think there's a sweet spot somewhere there in the middle where we believe that our strategy with bringing even a single identity into the market with a unitary structure, being able for clients to act quickly and having a partner that's able to act quickly across the full spectrum of sort of the programmatic media execution, the data insights, the analytics, the content creation and production, and sort of the full end-to-end consumer journey, sort of digital transformation piece, having somebody who both you know, from a consultative approach as well as a hands-on keyboard maker's mentality can combine that. I think there's room in the market for that. And that's what we've seen so far with the clients that we, not only globally, but also in Australia, have spoken to. They're very interested in that.
Just give us a sense of the sort of clients you're working for. I'm sure you're going to say you can't say that, but if it's not the names, then tell us some of the categories and industries that that you're doing work for. But names, please, Michelle, that'd be nice.
It's always about names, right?
Yes, exactly.
No, I think it's, to your point, I think it's, there are two sides to that. So we have, out of our platforms business, we work a lot with the different banks in Australia, the NABs, the ANZs, etc. So we have relationships there.
You're talking there about what was the BizTech part of the business that you acquired on the platform side?
Yeah, that is correct. On the Mighty Hive side, obviously, we work a lot with, you know, the likes of Country Road Group and Mayors and Vodafone New Zealand, etc. So I think it's a combination of both. I think to your first question as well, where you say, you know, ideally names, but you can imagine that clients don't want to talk about it, or we're not able to talk about it. I think it has mainly to do with the way how we approach clients and how we build up relationships. Like, not very often we are in the big pitches against the holding companies or the consultancy companies. And to be honest, you know, not saying that we're constantly saying no to that, but we're trying to avoid him as much as possible. And in some cases, we actually step out of it because we don't believe that how the current sort of pitching culture or pitching attitude that happens in the ecosystem is very beneficial for companies like ours. We're trying to push the boundaries. We're trying to have brands not act and operate in the way that they have been doing in the past. They need to transform. They need to change a lot of them. We're there to help. And the problem with a lot of the pitches right now, or that we've seen in the previous months, is that they're very one-size-fits-all, a pure procurement-led, and doesn't give a lot of room for partners that are forward-thinking and really want to push the boundaries on it. So in a world where, you know, and we're thankful for that, obviously, where we see have more of a supply demand that the supply issue than a demand issue, we chose not to take our key people out of the day-to-day business for 3 to whatever 6 months to work on pitches to eventually you know, win or lose a piece of business based on if we're able to fill in the Excel sheet in the same way than others. So a lot of our work that we do, and that's also one of the reasons why we can't talk about them, is not because we won the big top line pitches, but it's because we have more of a land and expand relationship with a lot of the clients where they've realized that we have certain unique features, and there's an opportunity to build up a relationship with a client and from there build it out.
So you're coming in from the side in many instances then, not necessarily from the big front end, because it's very entrenched behavior, Michelle, in terms of, I mean, it'll be regional and globally in terms of pitches and the way it's done. So I'm intrigued by how you sidestep that process where even the brand side will go and procurement will say, we want this, and it's very structured. How are you sidestepping that?
Well, I think to your point, I think it's, you know, you might call it the side door or the back door. For us, it's the front door. But a lot of these because we're a new company, right? And we don't have, or let us say, a lot of existing revenue streams from these clients and existing relationships with a lot of these clients. There is nothing to lose for us. Any sort of a dollar opportunity we can find through the front door, the side door, or back door by delivering services that are incremental for that potential client is for us an extra dollar. And I think that's very different from being in a very defensive position as the holding companies or the consultancies that are in a defense mode at the moment instead of an attack mode, if you want to use these words. I think the key thing there is that, you know, we've had conversations with clients where we went in through, again, call it the side door. And again, I prefer to call it our own front door, but we have these opportunities, and then it's all about being able to deliver them. Because, you know, the reality is, you know, and it's we are maybe not the most known and established party in any pitch situation or any sort of client conversation, right? Because we are the new people, although we have trusted maybe senior leaders who had these relationships for many years. We still have to prove ourselves. And, you know, having that land and expand opportunity and that strategy and doing that with the entrepreneurial mindset that a lot of our business leaders have, because they came in through mergers into the business and they've always been the challenger in their space, is a great opportunity to show that it doesn't have to be as slow moving and as difficult as it is with their current partner, but you can move quickly, snappy with fast results, and a lot of sort of clear touch points, and clients seem to like that at the moment, and that's why we're able to sort of expand that opportunity.
They're great points, but often on the client side, they're as slow, cumbersome, and bureaucratic as what some of the supply side on agencies or groups are as well. The approval process and all the things that need to happen. How are you breaking that down?
Well, it's a very interesting point because we actually, you know, we had a conversation with, there was almost sort of a pitch, to be honest, where a client, you know, the feedback from a client was, this is great, this is amazing, this is exactly what we need. This is what the future should be. We're not sure yet if we are ready for this right now, right? And I think that one of the biggest limitations of the success of our business is most likely the inability for brands to change at the same speed as we want to help them to change, right? But I think the key driver is finding within these brands the key drivers of change, you know, and those are often individuals or teams. And if we have conversations with clients or potential clients and they are not ready for it, there are two things to do. One, obviously break it down in smaller pieces and let them see that there is light at the end of that tunnel and guide them through that process. But the only way to do that is finding that ambassador internally who really wants to drive change. And the good thing right now is that more and more often we see that that driver of change is at C-level or is at the board, because they realize that if they don't change, you know, maybe the future of the business is at risk. And I think, you know, maybe a few years ago, I'm not sure if that realization was there yet. And the driver of change was probably not high enough in the organization to actually push that through the organization.
What's the strike rate there, Michelle, in terms of hitting those potential prospects, the prospect clients that are prepared to do it this way or shift the way they operate? Is it a 50-50, 1-2? How does it work?
It's significantly higher than that, thankfully. But I think a lot of that has to do with identifying or using the right opportunities in that. And that's where, you know, in some cases, maybe because of our relatively higher profile, or at least from a PR value at the moment in the market, we invited to a lot of those pitcher situations or client invites. And in some cases, we just have to say no to it because there is not that pure will and or ambassador internally to make that change. So the moment that we've identified that there are people that want to make the change and the brand is ready for it, the strike rate of that is significantly higher than 50%.
What is it then about your structure, your processes and your talent that allows you to deliver faster or at speed and faster than the consulting groups you talk about, the agency groups you talk about? What's going on there?
I think it's a few different things. One of them is, and we talk about this a lot, both internally and externally, is what we describe a unitary structure. And you know, having done about 10 years at WP myself, and obviously Sir Martin did over 30 years there, we have quite a lot of experience, and obviously we're not the only two, but we've quite a lot of experience within the holding groups. And if I look at that back at those 10 years for myself, one of the biggest frustrations I had was the way that we brought in amazing talent. And amazing talent, not from a recruitment point of view, but from an acquisition point of view. Because I don't think there is, you know, there is this shiny company that you think this is an amazing asset that I would love to use and present to all my clients, and I know it's going to help them. The moment that a holding company then does that acquisition, they put them on earnouts. And it means that eventually for the next 3 to 5 years, that executive team is only interested in maximizing the value in their own P&L. And you can't blame them for that, because that is how they have been sort of sold the story. So the ability to take that solution and present it to all your clients and use it across the organization is almost zero for the first 3 to 5 years, which is ridiculous if you think about it. So the way that we structure our organization in a unitary way is that when we do a merger, and that's the reason why we don't call them acquisitions, but mergers, when we merge with companies, we do the let's call it the purchase for a full 100%. So from day one, they're only vested in one thing, and that is bringing greater success to the total S4 organization. And what it does for brands is that from day one that business is in, you have 100% access to the brightest, most creative, most analytical, whatever type of business it is, across your full client portfolio. And I think that is the key differentiator with holding companies or the consultancies like Accenture.
But so one thing that's been in my mind for some time since Sir Martin launched S4 is exactly what you're talking about, valid points. But why didn't he, you're in WPP, why didn't he do that there? He was the guy that could have changed that at WPP in terms of the structures, the process, the KPIs, the incentivization, the way you acquire. Why did he not do it there?
I think it's a really good question, and I've asked him that question myself as well. Because when he said that we're gonna launch S4 and this is the idea, that was the first thing that came up in my mind as well. I think we I'm not sure if he's going to like if I'm going to say this, but I think we need to understand how big WPP grew and how much different forces there were and how much it actually took to make significant changes like this. Because if you do hundreds of acquisitions on an annual basis, tens to hundreds of acquisitions on an annual basis, the difference between doing an acquisition and buying it for 40, 50, 60, 70%, sort of what WP used to do versus 100%, has obviously significant impact on cash flow, risk, and matters like that. So it's very difficult the moment you're down a certain path to make that change. And I think the luxury that we have with S4 is the moment that the business started, you know, close to 2 years ago right now, it was a clean sheet of paper. So you can structure it in exactly the way that you feel fit for the future instead of for the past. And I think that's why it's like, if it was so easy to make that change, why didn't do WP it right now? Why didn't do Publicis do it or Dentsu or any of the other or even the Accentures of the world? Because they're stuck in the way that they do it right now. And it's very difficult to make the change. And that is the one of the reasons why you see holding companies struggle right now, is because they're really smart people there and they see what the future is going to look like, but they got this sort of 1,000-pound gorilla that they need to turn around. And a lot of the old stuff is sort of holding them back from being able to make that pivot and sail in the right direction.
In essence, Sir Martin became a prisoner of his own making in some cases, because I talk to a lot of the divisional CEOs in this market, and they lament and have lamented, for 15 years, about the onerous reporting lines, the limitations they can make on decision-making, the approval they've got to have to real estate to hire a secretary or a junior or a senior. It goes all the way to the top. Now, if it was such a problem, perhaps it's governance, but Sir Martin is greatly respected, but also a bloody control freak. And so why could he not have shifted that?
Yeah, you say it's a control freak. I think there are different views to that. I look at it in a different way, and I don't see him as a control freak. I do think he likes to be involved in a lot of things, but he also gives a lot of trust and confidence the moment that, you know, the business is run in the right way. And how much of a control freak can you be in a $17 billion company and about 150,000 employees? So I think it's all relative, and I also think that in a lot of cases, his control freakness has been used as an excuse for underperformance and incapability, if I'm really honest.
We'll get off WPP in a very short second, but you didn't seem to have that problem when you were at Xaxis, or was that because you were delivering? And there's a lot of scope for someone who's delivering on the numbers and delivering growth. You're a golden boy.
No, I think it was a golden team to start off with. I think the interesting thing about Xaxis at that time, and I say purposefully at that time, because, you know, the industry changed as well.
And the model, right? And your Xaxis model changed radically. It was good to start with.
Yeah, and if you look back at the model, what it was, it was a good model for that time. Like, you would never launch a business like that with that model. And that's the reason why Xaxis leadership, which is amazing leadership and still there and running a very sizable business, have changed the model to adjust to current times. And that's exactly what you need to do. And that's exactly what a Xaxis could do, because it has always been run very independently. Like, it wasn't an agency. It wasn't sort of looked at it from an agency perspective. And especially in the beginning phase, we had a lot of sort of freedom to operate more as a startup. But it was literally a startup on sort of steroids. In a space where obviously we were close to agencies and we were close to brands, and that's why we were able to grow really fast. And I think the reason why Xaxis was successful in WP versus a lot of the other, and I don't want to call them programmatic trading desks, but we sort of at that time were compared that way, why the others in the other holding groups were not so successful, is because they did not get that freedom. And one of the things that Sir Martin saw in a really early stage is the potential success of Xaxis, and gave it the freedom to develop itself and be that sort of startup under the umbrella of the wider group.
In retrospect, Michelle, what we saw of Xaxis doing early on, and gosh, that must have been, 2010, 11, 12, 13, where was it?
2011 was the kickoff. So I think 2013, 14, 15 were sort of prime years, yeah.
We've seen a lot since then talk about, and Zaxis was part of it, as were the whole sector, about, you know, even Mark Pritchard at P&G talked about the murky digital supply chain. And you guys were arbitraging and doing all sorts of interesting things that were right at the time and clever at the time and profitable at the time. It wasn't sustainable.
Partly it wasn't sustainable, but I also think that I think especially the press took a very sort of negative view on it, if I'm really honest, because Zaxis had and still have a lot of happy clients. And eventually what Zaxis positioning was at that time, I can't speak for what it is right now, but at that time was, you know, yes, we call it arbitrage, but we make a margin, but we also do a lot of upfront investment in, let it be trading commitments or let it be on technology, people, resources, data. So eventually it didn't operate it differently than, let's call it a net network at a time, but because it was owned by a holding company, all of a sudden there was a lot of scrutiny around it. And to be honest, and this is the last thing, what I want to say about it, is like, there have been multiple cases where brands have been outspoken about sort of being against the Zaxis business model. But once they were hitting the end of the year and certain targets were not hit yet, then all of a sudden there was a little bit more flexibility in their positioning towards Zaxis, because they knew that Zaxis was able to deliver the results. So, you know, that's, I mean, if it suits them, then all of a sudden the model is accepted. So,
and you're dead right in that it cuts both ways, and there was a little bit of responsibility shifting, you could say, to the supply side when perhaps there's all parties are involved. Take your point on that. So, listen, we'll move on. I want to get to the way that you operate. Now, if you think about media mix and content production and so forth, you're fast, you're furious, you turn around. What is it about this? You know, you talk about a fast and borderless world, centers of excellence and capability where it's happening 24 hours around the clock. Now, we have heard this for a number of years, even from the holding companies. The difference, it seems, that you guys are doing, you're actually delivering on, it's not rhetoric.
No, I think the interesting thing is, and it all comes back a little bit to sort of the unitary structure that I spoke about earlier, but let's take Media Monks for a sec. Media Monks is a content creation production business, creative content production business that exists for about 18 years. It started in a basement with a couple of Dutch guys and sort of built it out. And if you look at production companies like that, the majority of them hit a certain maximum growth capability because they did creative production in one specific vertical. They were good at, let it be film, or they were good at experiential, or they were good at AR, VR, or they were good at, but they never sort of get out of that, the skill of that. And the reason why they never grew out of that is because it's very difficult, especially in these project-based opportunities, to have a constant pipeline unless you're global, right? Because, you know, it's not on a retained business. Right? It's all sort of, at that time at least, it was all project-based. One of the things that Media Monks did really smart at that time, they started with a few small acquisitions, by a few shops that were specialized in other areas where they had not a lot of know-how about yet, but knew it was close to what they were doing. An example of that is a relatively small, 150, 200 people shop in Sao Paulo. And there's a literally sort of a factory with a bunch of people, the brightest you could find, around sort of robotics and experiential and like really cool stuff. Like, having that as a center of excellence, it doesn't make sense to replicate that to multiple markets, right? Because it's all project-based. And it's the same with, like, in Hilversum, which is about 30-minute ride outside of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, they've probably got about 150, 200 people of the best of the best around VR and AR. And in Amsterdam, they brought in a small tabletop a company. We did tabletop shoots where you see all this like melting chocolate and popping bottles of champagne and all that stuff, like which is a specialism. So right now, if somebody in Shanghai sells an experiential robotic something, it's going to be built in Sao Paulo, shipped to Shanghai. If somebody wants melted chocolate in an ad in Australia, that's being shot in Amsterdam. Hey, the chocolate looks the same there. It's not really chocolate, by the way. That was the biggest disappointment in my life. I don't think you want to eat it. But since I've been in that studio, like I look at ads in a total different way. That's for sure. and food ads especially. And I think being able to do that and building up these production center of excellence brings the brightest of the brightest together and does that at scale. So MediaMonks is built in a way that they have production ops centers of excellence at the different locations for production needs that are sort of less time bound. Like in a tabletop shoot, obviously you can do that sort of from a distance, or, you know, robotic stuff, you can do that from Sao Paulo. They are not time bound, user centers of excellence. Fine. That setup is great. Then they have services offices across the globe, which I think is about 30 odd of them, which obviously help brands in the market itself. And then there are production capabilities that are sitting across the different time zones. So when it comes to, for example, to content creation, like let it be ads or any sort of messaging that has shorter turnaround times, there are production hubs in, you know, Buenos Aires, Los Angeles, London, Amsterdam, Singapore, etc. So eventually it follows the sun 24/7 on production capabilities to throw out sort of high volume creative production. So for the different type of production capabilities, there's a different setup. But because everything is in a unitary structure, like you can tap into any resource across MediaMonks and Mighty Hive and all the business that we brought in under these two umbrellas without have to worry about where does that revenue sit? How can I intercompany charge from one side to another side? We don't have that. We probably have the smallest finance organization you can have because we don't have that internal bullshit.
How are your markets, your countries, your divisions, how are they KPI'd? Because everything you talk about there, you hear is done by others, whether it's consulting firms with their, you know, retail specialists.
But it's not. That's the whole thing. They talk about it, but it's not. Like a one publicist or like we're like even the within WPP, the agencies that were set up specifically for brands. Right. Well, we had this trend, obviously, for a while. And you have like a few people from creative, a few people from media, a few people. There's this special agency we set up. At the back, there's still an allocation from revenues going from one side to another side. And there's still a fight about it.
Right. So how do you beat that? Your people and your divisions and your brands have still got to be KPI'd somehow rather than being a big melting pot where the underperformers are getting as much as the overperformers. How do you deal with that?
So eventually the people like – so. Obviously, there is leadership, let's call it sort of leadership at the top. A lot of them were founders of the businesses that we brought in, right? They are 100% KPI'd on the S4 performance. And the reason why 100% KPI'd on that is because, one, when they merged their business into S4, they got 50% cash and they got 50% S4 stock. Like, we're a publicly listed and traded company in London. So they care, like, how do we grow this total pie? Because everybody gets better out of it. If you go down in the organization, you see that people are KPI'd on personal KPIs, and it's more often the soft KPIs, which I think is very important that we look at that. And the rest is on the overall S4 performance. So it doesn't matter. We have an MD. I'm in Singapore right now, but we have an MD in Singapore who can fight hard for a client and would all love sees the client being invoiced out of LA, for example, because that's where we already have an existing client. Financial relationship with that client. No problem at all. Never a discussion about where that sits in the P&L. And I can tell you, from 10 years WPP, that probably frees up 25% of my time on a weekly basis by not having those type of conversations.
Great points. Okay, so I think I'm nearly convinced that you might be onto something, Michelle. the just very quickly, you talk about centers of excellence, South America, Scandinavia, and Shanghai, for instance. Is there one in Australia?
Absolutely.
Or will there be one?
No, there is one, and that is our the old BizTech business, which is our Adobe AM development business.
Just to be clear, though, BizTech was in Australia, in Melbourne. It had operations in, I think, Canada, Russia, and Kazakhstan. What the hell's going on there?
No, I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, we can't deny, obviously, the quality of development capabilities in countries like Kazakhstan or Russia. But I think the interesting thing is, like, Just walk with me for a second. Like, so MediaMonks is really good at the creative, the graphical side of consumer journeys, for example, right? So let it be from an ads perspective, let it be from a content perspective, etc. They're good at UI, they're good at UX. More and more they had opportunities to move into the actual platform build, so Adobe Experience Manager, etc. I'm not sure if you've ever tried to hire Adobe Experience Manager specialist, but they're like very difficult to find. then there is a BizTech business that is doing extremely well in that area. Got about 100 people divided over, you know, mainly Australia, so Kazakhstan, Russia, and a little bit in Canada at that time, that has high recognition with Adobe. One of the co-founders is the most rewarded Adobe specialist in the world. They have that existing relationship with Adobe. And coming back to the one of the first points, S4's business is building services on top of the key technology platforms. And Adobe is a key technology platform. So we did the merger with BizTech to, one, you know, build, have a service solution on top of Adobe, having 80, 90, 100 Adobe specialists all of a sudden, you know, under the fold. As well as have built that service organization on top of one of the key technology platforms, business, Adobe. So that rebranded into MediaMonks, and that's the foundation of our global Adobe business at the moment, because the Melbourne, Sydney, Kazakhstan, Russia team are delivering projects in Canada at the moment, in the Middle East, in the US, in Europe, and in Australia, everywhere. So that's one of the centers of expertise, and that's why there's a small chance that, well, yeah, there's zero chance that we're going to build another AEM business outside of this organization. You know, the BizTech, which we now call MediaMonks, obviously, but outside of that BizTech organization.
And so, you know, it may be the inferiority complex that we Australians have about being at the arse end of the world, but I sit there and say, out of all the options you had to build that particular expertise, you chose a Melbourne company for your global expertise, and there wasn't anything in America, Europe, UK, Asia that could have delivered what you needed. You went to Melbourne.
It almost sounds as a complaint, Paul.
Yeah, I think I might be being slightly provocative, so forgive me for that. But I mean, it still begs the point. You did come to Australia for a global Adobe expertise. The Americans are, you know, they're evangelical about this stuff. Surely there would have been America would have been an obvious spot.
Yeah, it is. But the reality is also that, like, and if you look at, for example, the global leadership of S4, we're all spread across the globe. We're not a heavily US-centered organization or UK-centered organization. And we look at where we can find the best people. And the reality is we're not gonna be in 150 or 200 countries like back in the days, maybe holdcos and or consultancies were doing. We're gonna be strategically in about 35-40 countries in the world max, because we believe that we can cover with that. And within that, those 35-40 markets, we look for the best. And these guys were really good, are really good, and eventually we're bringing that discipline to other markets. Like, nobody would think that our robotics development and experiential development center would be in Sao Paulo. That would not be your first pick. Well, they're really great in what they do, and that's why, you know, we see it in all the stuff that we've in.
Okay, I'm coming to a close because I've taken too much of your time. But just on that that BizTech and MediaMonks acquisition in Australia, you've got Adobe, so you build that out globally, the expertise. But if you're a services business based on, built on platforms, then where is your expertise in Salesforce, Oracle, SAP, Google Marketing Cloud? Are they going to be integrated all into the MediaMonks business with different divisions? How do you build that expertise?
So there's a couple of there. So on the Google side, obviously we're pretty well established, including cloud, and that sits in our MightyHive business. We've announced probably about 3 months ago another merger in Australia of a company called Lens10, also in Melbourne and Sydney. We're still waiting for sort of final government approval. Because of COVID, there's a little bit of a slight delay on that, but it should be closed hopefully soon.
That's with the Foreign Investment Review Board, I imagine. Is that what's happening there?
Exactly, yeah. The FARB,
yes.
which was pretty Australian, unique, we've experienced. But that should be all right. That one, obviously, that we have the Adobe expertise. We just announced last month, I'm losing time a little bit, probably about last month, the merger with a Amazon specialist in Seattle. And we got another, you know, a couple of hands full of potential mergers coming up. And a lot of the platforms that you're talking about, you know, the Salesforce of the world, are obviously high on our list. So, you know, expect some more news in that area. If we really are going into like the SAP type stuff,
which is more ERP, right? It's enterprise resource planning and stuff. It's a bit too macro.
Yeah. So I wouldn't expect anything per se there yet for the foreseeable future. But I think especially on the Salesforce side, but then also in China around the Ali and the Tencent side, you can expect some more development soon.
Will S4 ever buy into some sort of traditional ad shop?
Like traditional as in traditional media?
Both.
No, like you never know, obviously. But the fact that we're pure digital and have nothing of that, let's call it old stuff, doesn't make a lot of sense for us to invest in that. And that's what we see with a lot of clients who want us to, you know, work on their offline business as well. We friendly decline that opportunity because it's, I don't know, why would you move into a business that doesn't grow?
Yes, but I think there's a legend has as well that Sir Martin Sorrell used to say that too before he bought, what was it, Ogilvy or whatever it was, way back. So I'm not discounting that one yet, Michelle. I have to say I'm not believing it yet. Acquisitions, final one. Further acquisitions in Australia or you've got it sorted now?
No, like Australia is not that far away from me. So we're still looking at Australia. Ideally also spread a little bit more across the APAC region or the globe. The reality is there actually there are quite a lot of interesting and good shops in Australia. So don't be surprised if there will be something in the press in the foreseeable future.
Ooh, there's a teaser. Final one, the region. I know I said that last time, but this is the final one. The region, there is rising geopolitical tension globally, and obviously you're in the hot spot now between, you know, the West and the East and what's going on there. Does that give you some heightened risk about your growth prospects for the Asia region at least? How do you manage and juggle that? Is it a concern?
Is it a concern? Yes, it's a concern. And I think, you know, the highly geopolitical issues, not only across the region, but especially across the globe, I think, should be a concern for everybody because I don't think it's good for anybody. If you look at like how we see the longer term future, as well as what our strategy is that we've always believed that about 40% of our revenue should come from the Americas, about 40% should come from APAC, and about 20% from Europe. We're not there yet because probably right now it's about 10-15% coming out of APAC. So we have a long way to grow. And we know that outside of Australia, India, Japan, we obviously also need China. And that's where a lot of the tension is right now. We still strongly believe in China, and we will continue to build out our organic business there, as well as we're very active in the acquisition side.
Has it changed already the way that you operate in China and Hong Kong, for that matter?
No, I mean, obviously, we see that in Hong Kong. It's trickier, not per se because of the geopolitical, but especially what it means for brands at the moment in Hong Kong. We see a lot of people, you know, brand Spencer have been going down significantly there after, you know, all the different issues they've had there in the last year and a half or so. But we'll continue to grow fast in China and focus on China. And let's hope that the geopolitical issues are going to be resolved somewhere by the end of this year.
Well, listen, I better let you go and run the emerging, burgeoning empire that is S4. How far away are we from this announcement of an acquisition? Are we talking weeks, months in Australia, that is?
I'll keep you posted.
Nice. You are destined to be a politician. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks, Paul.
MI3 Audio Edition was presented by Paul McIntyre, that's moi, in collaboration with Podcast One Australia. Producer Nick Slater, music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to podcastone.com.au or search MI3 Audio Edition on Apple Podcasts and hit the subscribe button.